Good afternoon and welcome to Open Air, KALW's weekly radio magazine of most things culturally considered. I'm your host, David LaTulipe, with once again a robust and I hope entertaining hour for you. This week, Francis Wallace, Director of Strategic Partnerships and Programmer for Frameline, will talk about the 37th Frameline Film Festival. Actress Sammy Granberg, in the title role of A.R. Gurney's play Sylvia, talks with director Kali Johnson about their production of the play at the Fort Mason Theater, presented by Shakespeare at Stinson and Independent Cabaret Productions. And thereminist Dalit Hadas Warshaw shares her music and talks about that most unusual instrument, the theremin, that will be featured in this Sunday's chamber music concert with members of the San Francisco Symphony. Plus, looking for some good books to read this summer? Not sure where to start? No worries. Book critic Peter Robinson will be here with some engaging page-turners for your vacation. Whether it's a day on the beach, something for the plane, perhaps, or maybe an audiobook for a car trip, stay tuned for Peter's 10 Best Summer Reads for KALW readers and listeners. All that just ahead, as well as some ticket giveaways, so stay with us. That's a brief excerpt from Transformation for String Quartet and Theremin, a string-sounding-like instrument that's not a stringed instrument at all. We've all heard the sound before, the theremin, whether in a scary movie or some version of a theremin in a Beach Boys tune. But here to give us a bit of the theremin is is virtuoso Dalit Hadas Warshaw, heard here in a track from her CD, In Invocations. Dalit is an acclaimed composer, educator, pianist, and thereminist, whose works have been performed by many ensembles, including the New York and Israel Philharmonics, the Boston Symphony, Cleveland Orchestra, among others. And she has performed theremin with an equally illustrious list of ensembles, adding to that list collaboration with members of the San Francisco Symphony for a chamber music concert this Sunday that will feature two of her own works. Dalit, welcome to KLW.
Thank you so much.
Well, let's talk about the theremin. Invented by Russian Leon Theremin in the 1920s.
Yes, 1919, actually.
1919.
Yes. Among lots of other inventions, he also was the inventor behind the notorious bug that was and still is in use in some capacity in high security.
Interesting. I didn't know that.
Alarm systems. The invention attracted the attention of Lenin, who sent Termen on a tour of Europe and the United States to advertise, represent Soviet genius. He also happened to be an amateur cellist, I think, which is extremely relevant to the very important aspect of this instrument, which is that even though it's electronic, there's something very paradoxically human about its sound.
Is it considered the first electronic instrument?
It's one of them.
And the original use wasn't intended as a musical instrument, was it? We're talking about Stalin-era Soviet Union.
Although Termen himself actually was quite a romantic. You could go on YouTube and find clips of his actually demonstrating Camille Saint-Saëns' The Swan on this instrument.
Mm-hmm. Well, for those of us, it's kind of hard on radio to describe it physically, but it's not an instrument anything like you've ever seen before. Describe it for us.
Well, it is it's very singular in that it is an entirely no-contact instrument. There are two radio frequency oscillators, each controlled by an antenna. One antenna is for frequency, the other is for amplitude. What one does is stand in front of a wooden box where there is the vertical frequency antenna and a horizontal volume antenna. Usually it's the right hand that operates the frequency antenna, but because we're dealing with electromagnetic field, essentially any object is that comes in the way of this field, it's going to affect pitch.
Oh, that's fascinating.
If we had a theremin here, what I might have done to demonstrate is sustain a pitch and have someone walk on the other side of the instrument within the field, and you could just see how, for one thing, how extremely sensitive the instrument is.
Wow.
But also how you're deriving everything from the air. So what one, the way as a player, the way I conceive of this is that the air, the distance between where I'm standing and the pitch antenna is kind of like a an imaginary fluctuating fingerboard where one gauges distances between intervals. And one could create very beautiful music, ideally.
It's a perfect discussion for radio, right? Because we're talking actually about radio waves that you're interrupting that are audible that you normally don't see in the air.
And actually, that's a really important point because apparently the inspiration for the instrument came about when Termen was tinkering with a broken radio. I forget the engineering details of how that how that resulted, but that was the origin.
And how did you first come to discover it yourself?
Well, it was quite serendipitous and a bit random. I began as a pianist from a very early age. When I was 4 years old, I was introduced to Nadia Reisenberg, a brilliant pianist and piano teacher at Juilliard at the time. Her sister happened to be Clara Rockmore, who was the muse of Lev Termen, who really created out of this instrument a very beautiful classical voice.
Wow, so you actually studied with the person that was the protege of Theremin himself.
I did.
Wow.
I did. And also just to show how intense my connection with both sisters happened to be, it was Nadia who was responsible for my beginnings as a composer. And then when she died, Clara assumed this role as a mentor, not just as a theremin player, but just as an incredible musician, artist.
Mm. Where did you study with her?
Oh, privately.
In New York? Or
yes.
In New York. She was in New York.
Yes. And then much later on, I was in a double degree program between Columbia and Juilliard, but that had nothing to do with the theremin.
I was going to say, I don't think you can major in theremin at Juilliard, can you?
Not yet.
Not. Touché. Yeah, I'm sure they're working on any kind of program to get some more people out there on these more unusual instruments that are piquing people's attention.
I hear there's an Ont-Martineau program at McGill University.
Ah, well, it's inevitable. It's
going to inevitable.
Come. Now,
yes.
Apparently, RCA had some real grand plans for the commercialization of the theremin. They were considering it in every man's instrument, that every like a household piano, everyone would have a theremin.
Yes.
Why didn't that work?
Well, and I think it was partly because it was marketed as being the easiest instrument to play. All one had to do was stand in front of it and wave one's hands and draw music out of the ether, like magic. But it's not quite so simple. If you try the theremin, you'd see how difficult it is to sustain a pitch, for one thing.
I have to say, I have tried the theremin. A dear friend, Allison Sniffen, back in New York, studied theremin, and she could play the swan and everything. She encouraged people to try it. And it's unlike having a keyboard in front of you, or having even frets, or even a fretless soundboard to move your fingers on a regular basis. It really is picking these pitches out of the air and then ever so subtly moving your hands.
Yes. Not only that, I think this is something also important to mention, because it's entirely unique to this instrument. You're carving volume and expression and silence out of the air as well. This is the only instrument I can think of where the default state of the instrument is sound, meaning that when I am playing, it means that I'm actively playing rests and I'm playing staccato. I'm not resting my hand during those silences. It's an active sort of thing. So I see it kind of as carving a stone sculpture out of a slab of rock. You're performing in negative space.
Mm. You know, you mentioned how the proximity of your hand to the instrument changes the pitch so easily and from a long distance. I just thought of a great composition that, I don't know, maybe theremin thought of this. Put the theremin in a bubble and put a bumblebee inside it.
Oh, my goodness.
And have a flight of the bumblebee that would be actually recording the flight of the bumblebee by theremin.
Oh, that's great.
I don't think it would quite work. Just a thought. Let's turn to more serious compositions that you have on your CD, Invocations.
Sure.
Talk to us about this CD that you put together.
Okay, well, it's a CD that was released in 2011 on Albany Records, and it represents a diverse sampling of everything that I write. I've written a lot for orchestra. That's the one kind of ensemble that is not featured on the CD, but I have a string quartet. I have piano solo, which I perform because I'm also a serious pianist, solo cello, voice, and I introduce the theremin in relation to various types of ensembles. I think actually using the theremin in acoustic instrumental settings is something that's still a very new kind of thing, and there's so many possibilities that can be tapped into. So the excerpt that we just heard was from a piece of mine called Transformation for theremin and string quartet. The theremin that I used to record the piece actually was Clara Rockmore's theremin, which has an especially string kind of timbre to it. So I thought it melded quite well. But the kinds of timbres you could achieve on the instrument, I mean, it runs the gamut.
Hmm. So how did use of the theremin even become a part of the possibility of a San Francisco Symphony Chamber Concert?
Oh, a random sort of story. I released the CD, and I released it in the year of Clara's 100th birthday, and wrote an article about it in the Juilliard Journal. I'm an alumna from that institution. And Barbara Bogatin, who is the cellist on Sunday's program and a member of the symphony, she read the article, and I had mentioned a particular concert I was involved in back in 1990, in which Clara was featured on the theremin, and Barbara happened to be in attendance, and basically everything clicked, and they invited me out here.
Very nice. Also on the program on this Sunday at 2 o'clock, it's the San Francisco Chamber Musicians, Kate Kotorak on viola, Barbara Bogatin, cellist, Robin Sutherland on piano, as well as Mark Shapiro on piano. They'll be performing Martin Neu's Piano Quintet No. 1, as well as Brahms' Piano Quartet in A Major Opus 26. And a couple of works by you. We heard the first Transformation for String Quartet and Theremin. And tell us about what we're going to hear now, a brief excerpt from the work that will also be heard on Sunday.
Yes. The piece is called Nis Cora, and it was written in memoriam to Clara on what would have been her 90th birthday. The version we'll hear on Sunday is for theremin, cello, and piano. That's the original version. But what you'll hear now on the CD is something that can only be achieved in a recording studio. What I decided to do was play all the parts. So what I did was I recorded the piano part myself, then overdubbed on top the cello part as a theremin 2 on my Moog replica of Clara's instrument.
All right.
It has a very distinctive sound in that it also has an internal amplifier, so there's a woody celloistic sound to it. Finally, theremin 1 is played by me on Clara's theremin. So I created this three-way conversation between these three instruments, reconciling all of my musical identities as composer, pianist, and theremin.
Well, there you go. We're going to hear this now. Dalit Hadas-Warshaw, thanks so much for taking some time today on KLW.
Thank you.
And best of wishes on Sunday's performance. More information at sfsymphony.org. Here now, an excerpt from Dalit's work, Nisk Ora, for cello, piano, and theremin, with the cello in this case being replaced by a second theremin. Just a taste of Nisk Ora for cello, piano, and theremin, a work by Dalit Warshaw that you can hear in its entirety this coming Sunday with members of the San Francisco Symphony Orchestra chamber musicians. Information at sfsymphony.org. Still to come, summer book recommendations from critic Peter Robinson, a chat with one of the cast members and the director of A.R. Gurney's Sylvia, now playing at the Fort Mason Theater, and a premiere of Frameline 37. On the heels of the San Francisco Documentary Film Festival, which concludes this Sunday, which was preceded by the Noir Fest, the Silent Film Festival, the San Francisco International Film Festival, the Himalayan Film Festival, well, now comes the highly anticipated Frameline 37, the internationally renowned showcase for lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender, and queer cinema, for a jam-packed 11 days celebrating LGBT LMNOP films, expected to reach some 60,000 audience members this year over 11 days. Frameline is the world's largest LGBT media arts nonprofit organization, and I'm very pleased to welcome Francis Wallace, Director of Strategic Partnerships and Programmer for Frameline, to Open Air and KLW. Francis, welcome.
Thanks, David. Thank you.
A daunting but exciting 11 days ahead. How are things looking this year?
Just extraordinary, actually. I would say one of the greatest film lineups that we've ever had. Yeah.
Well, among the stats, our full-length features are 14 U.S. films and films from some 30 countries. It's amazing what's being represented here.
Yeah, there's the first lesbian narrative feature from Nepal and a lesbian narrative feature out of Cambodia as well. So,
oh, my goodness.
Yeah.
What else can you tell us about things to look forward to in this festival?
Well, there's a few real highlights. I tend to work on the documentary side of the festival, so I just wanted to bring to light, there's an exceptional documentary about James Broughton, Big Joy, The Adventures of James Broughton, and it's basically the story of Broughton as he came out of the San Francisco Renaissance post-World War II, and he's a writer, filmmaker, sexual liberator, and he really set the tone for San Francisco and kind of the tone of the city and queer filmmaking.
Well, we actually have a little excerpt from that film. Let's hear it now, just a brief excerpt from this film.
When I started to make my first film, it was to a large extent to see what my dreams really looked like, to make them very real.
James will continually be rediscovered as this kind of golden secret of West Coast Bohemia. He was an outsider's outsider under the underground.
James Broughton was a trickster. He had a way of getting at the serious by focusing on the silly. And that's very seductive because it creeps up on you.
I see him in the visionary tradition of Blake, Whitman, Ginsberg. In many ways, he was as visionary as they were. But where Whitman alludes to the pleasures of the flesh, James was somebody who lived it.
And that's a brief joy from a brief excerpt from Big Joy, The Adventures of James Broughton, which will be screened Saturday, June 22nd, this Saturday at 4 o'clock at the Castro. I'm here with Francis Wallace, Director of Strategic Partnerships and Programmer for Frameline 37, getting underway tonight at the Castro. If you're going to go, get there early. It's going to be quite a jam-packed scene, I think.
Yeah, absolutely.
Now, the shorts programs are always a favorite. Until this year, they were called Fun and Boy Shorts and Fun and Girl Shorts, but now it looks like it's been greatly expanded. Can you tell us anything about the history of the shorts or how those shorts are selected? It must be an amazing amount of submissions for this.
Yeah, we have over 500 shorts film submissions, and there's three senior programmers, but we also have outside crews assist us on that front to kind of cut down the list.
Mm-hmm. And you're working out of New York, so how does that work? What comes to you in New York, and what is your specialty in for Frameline?
My specialty is documentary film, and I kind of research all of the New York-based film festivals for LGBT content.
Mm-hmm. And are you able to catch a good part of the festival while you're out here in San Francisco?
Or? Oh, yeah, yeah. I'm here for quite a few months every year. Yeah, I used to live here, so I moved between the two cities.
Mm-hmm. What got you into film originally and into this aspect of film?
I grew up on the island of Tasmania, and there was one alternative theater, cinema, and every month they would change the film. So when I was about 13, that was the only way to see the outside world.
And not much opportunities beyond that, let alone a gay film festival for that.
No, I don't think I saw anything gay there, but I think there is now, thank God.
When was your first, you said you were former San Francisco, was that when you first encountered Frameline?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yes, yeah. I used to go work on the Melbourne Queer Film Festival and the Melbourne International Film Festival in Australia. And yes, actually my first week in arrival into San Francisco, I went to the opening night of Frameline. Mm-hmm. Yes.
And I know it's hard to play favorites, but what are you looking forward to in this festival?
You know, I have a couple of picks. The Lesbiana, A Parallel Revolution, which is a joint Canadian-US documentary, which is about the second wave of feminists in the 70s, 80s, and kind of the work they did in terms of also creating writings and theatre and culture and music on both of those fronts and how it ties together. Exceptional documentary.
Mm-hmm. And tonight's film is called Concussion. It starts at the Castro at 7 p.m. Again, if you're interested in attending this opening night, do arrive early. Information on all things Frameline at frameline.org. We do have a couple of pairs of tickets that we're offering for both Big Joy, The Adventures of James Broughton. That's for Saturday, June 22nd at 4 p.m. at the Castro, The Adventures of James Broughton, Saturday, 4 p.m. at the Castro. And for Lesbiana, A Parallel Revolution, which is screening next Tuesday afternoon, June 25th at 2 p.m. at the Castro Theater. If you're interested in screening passes for that, give us a call here at the studios, 415-841-4134. That's 841-4134 for a pass or two to Lesbiana, A Parallel Revolution, or Big Joy, The Adventures of James Broughton. So, Francis, how do you get through these 11 days?
Lots of water. Actually, you have to keep hydrated. And you just keep remembering all of the creators and the artists and the writers. We're really just the courier service that brings all their blood, sweat and tears to the screen. So keep remembering those people.
Very good. Francis, thanks so much for taking some time today on Frameline. Anything else you want to mention about the festival that piques your fancy or you want to make us aware of?
Also closing night, actually, GBF,
sure.
Yeah, which is June 30th. All tickets are at frameline.org. And, yeah, there's just a huge program, over 240 films. So check it out.
Francis Wallace, one of the directors of Frameline and one of the programmers for Frameline 37. Again, all things Frameline at frameline.org. Thanks again, Francis, for coming in.
Thank you so much.
Well, not so much a doggy in the window, but a dog in the park that catches the eye of Greg, one of the actors in the independent cabaret productions and Shakespeare at Stinson production of Sylvia, a play by A.R. Gurney, which is being directed by Kali Johnson at Fort Mason Theater. Director Kali Johnson and actress Sammy Granberg, who plays the dog Sylvia, join me in studio to discuss this rather imaginative take on midlife crisis. Kali, Sammy, welcome to KALW in open air.
Hi. Thanks for having us.
And might I say, Sammy, sit. Sit.
Yeah, I get that a lot.
good actress. Now, Sammy, you count among your favorite roles, according to some press release that I received, Lady Macduff in Macbeth, uh-huh, and Mary Magdalene in, uh-huh, The Last Days of Judas Iscariot. You were trained in Texas and the National Theater Institute at the O'Neill in Connecticut, a wonderful institution. But it seems your career at this point has kind of gone to the dogs.
Well, it's actually a really exciting time for me right now because I just recently came to the Bay Area to kind of get things started over here. And so I'm really loving it over here. I'm originally from Oregon, mm-hmm, so I'm a West Coast girl at heart.
Right. Did you do some acting up in Oregon?
Just like high school and things like that. I left to go kind of adventure in the
in Texas and in Chicago, and then so I still have a home up in Oregon, and now I am starting to get a home in San Francisco.
So. Now, you're not actually a dog in a dog costume.
No.
For this production.
No.
So let's talk about the premise of the show with Callie Johnson, director of the show. How did you come by the works of A.R. Gurney?
Actually, Jeffrey Trotter was the producer, already had the rights to it, and he was actually looking for a director. And I had actually acted in many productions, Shakespeare at Stinson. And so we were just talking, and he said, why don't you direct this? So I jumped at it because I've always, I've mostly acted, so I've always had a hankering to direct.
Mm-hmm.
So I thought, yeah, this would be terrific.
Well, it's supposedly an imaginative take on midlife crisis. So set this up for us. What's going on, and how is the dog related to the human actors when they're all humans on stage?
Yeah. So Greg and Kate have moved to Manhattan. They got kids in college. And Greg is kind of tired of his job. He wants to check out a little bit. And his wife, Kate, is actually on a high career track. So she doesn't want kids or dogs. So Greg actually finds Sylvia in the park and brings her home, and Kate does not approve. So it kind of goes from there, and it exposes sort of a bit of a crack in their marriage. And so Sylvia, being played by a girl, a young girl who talks and talks back and is sassy, kind of opens the fissures of their marriage problems a little bit. But it's all lighthearted. It's funny. And I think when Gurney wrote this, and this came out in 95, people were starting to really, I think the wave of fetishizing your animals was really coming in. So the idea that, Greg actually thinks of the dog as human and talks to her and the dog talks back, makes for interesting, funny moments.
Yeah, I think we've all kind of anthropomorphized our pets at some point. Now it's just a little bit more evident and obvious what the subtext might be with actual humans.
Yeah.
So tell us, Sammy, what happens when Sylvia meets a cat in the park?
Oh, yeah.
That you can say on radio.
She definitely does not like cats. And I think we've all had those instances with our dogs that something like that they just don't see in their everyday life with their animal curled up next to them. They see an animal, and then they just get the instincts to attack and tear that little creature up. kind of a fun moment of just snapping into that instinct of animal.
And with a tirade of
four-letter words. So she's kind of a scrappy dog, kind of from the streets and street smarts, which kind of makes for an interesting moment between, or many moments between her and Kate, who's has this new Manhattan apartment and wants to have this New York lifestyle, and this kind of urchin comes from the streets to kind of take ownership of that.
Mm. It must be fun as an actress being able to let loose a little bit more than you would normally for maybe Lady Macbeth.
Yes. It's actually was a really good role for me because I was able to kind of just have, it's a really fun role and get into the physicality of it. And then since dogs think more simply and it's more black, white, I love you.
Squirrel.
Yeah, exactly.
Distraction.
Wins dinner. I was able to kind of let go of some of my actor-human instincts to overcomplicate the character and just kind of really immerse myself in these very simple, fundamental feelings.
So, Callie, did you speak down to Sammy in more dog terminology? How did you tame this actress? Housebreak her first?
Yeah. It was a little, we talked about, we wanted to keep it as simple, not to overcomplicate it, because the dogs are survivors. They do what they have to do, so they're kind of like children, right? They can really manipulate us. And what was so wonderful is that just kind of letting Sammy go Each day she would bring some little new nuance that was like, oh my God, wonderful, keep that. And she just kept layering the dog from just the ground up, all the little movements. And you know, she doesn't move as a dog the entire time. I mean, she kind of goes back and forth for humans. She's not like on all fours the whole time. Uh-huh. So there's a great blurring of how human she is and how doggy she is. And I think Sammy just strikes the perfect pitch of little dog movements and...
So, Sammy, the role is evolving each night that you perform it.
Yeah, and even because we've had a longer run, which has been nice because with each performance, it's just kind of getting more and more synced in and finding new things each night. And we have a great cast that I'm able to work off of with David Shirk and Jocelyn Rohde and Tim Green. So it's been great every night to kind of surprise myself.
Yeah. And how long is the performances running through?
So it goes through the end of the month, through June 30th. We have Thursday, Friday, Saturday this week, and Sunday at Fort Mason. And then next week, the Thursday and Friday, 27th, 28th, at Fort Mason. And then for the final two shows, we move to Sweetwater Music Hall, which is on 19 Corte Madera Avenue in Mill Valley, and that's Saturday and Sunday at 2 p.m.
So is the production itself must be easily transportable just for those two nights you're going for this?
Right. So it was originally scheduled to or slated to be at three different venues. We started at Live Oak Theater in Berkeley for the first 2 weeks, then we moved to the Fort Mason space, and then the three performances at the Sweetwater Music Hall. So the design had to necessarily be simple. We could pack it up, move it. Calvin Jung designed the set and their projections to, you know, set scene and mood and so forth. Richard Chicarone, good friend of mine, did the sound. So we really had a good team. And I just have to plug my cast. It's like they made my life so simple and they brought so much to the table and just a joy to work with all of them. So it's been a blast.
Very nice. Hey, yeah. So, Sammy, you've gone from Lady Macbeth to Sylvia. Any other great animals coming your way and your repertoire chops as a master thespian?
Yeah. I have a couple of projects in the works that I'm confirming and auditioning a lot. And I'm always looking for other opportunities.
Well, information about the remaining performances in San Francisco and Mill Valley are at cabaretsf.wordpress. We do have some tickets to give away. We have 5 pairs of tickets that have been offered for these remaining San Francisco performances. Again, those being Thursday the 20th at 8 tonight, the 21st at 8, Saturday at 8, and then Sunday at 7, as well as next Friday and Saturday. If you'd like a pair of tickets for these concerts at the Fort Mason Theater, you can call us now at our studios, 415-841-4134. That's 841-4134 for tickets to Sylvia. And I'm going to thank once again Sammy and Kali for coming by to spend some time with us to tell us about this really fun show.
Yeah, thank you so much.
Thank you very much for having us.
Who let the dogs out?
Was nice, the party was pumping.
Yippee-i-yo.
And everybody having a ball.
Yippee-i-yo.
Until the fellas started in calling.
Yippee-i-yo.
And the girls respond to the call. I have a poor one shout out.
Who let the dogs out? Who let the dogs out? Who let the dogs out? Who let the dogs out?
I see the donkey. Billy Bond, get out. Get back, Ruffy. Bash
Who Let the Dogs Out, indeed. I should mention that in addition to Frameline getting away, I mentioned that the San Francisco Documentary Fest is winding up this Sunday. Well, tonight, as an apt segue from Sylvia, is the film Forever, which is directed by Amy Finkel, which deals with how people deal with the loss of a beloved pet. How much grief is acceptable? Is it okay to order a customized dog ash pendant, but too weird to keep a taxidermied cat on the couch for your own comfort? Well, this film, Forever, observes the sometimes strange, sometimes heartbreaking efforts to preserve a pet's memory. The result is one of DocFest's most thought-provoking films. That's at the San Francisco DocFest. More information at sfindie.com, sfindie.com.
If they asked me, I could write a book about the way you walk and whisper and look. I could write a preface on how we met, so the world would never forget. And the simple secret of the plot is just to tell them that I love you a lot. Then the world discovers, as my book ends, how to make two lovers a friend.
The great voice of Harry Connick Jr. introducing our final segment here on KLW. And it's all about books. You know what to read this summer? I couldn't write a book. I guess Harry could. Not sure where to start? Well, our critic Peter Robinson is here with some engaging page-turners for your vacation, whether it's for your trip to the beach, maybe a audiobook for a car trip. Peter Robinson, welcome back to
Hi, David. Good to be here.
On open air.
Good to be here. And wonderful music. Yeah, wonderful music. It's just kind of got me musically thinking about books. And I'm lucky. I often take the ferry, and a friend sometimes brings me up here. And cruising across the bay today on this glorious sunshine really makes me appreciate life on the top deck. And commuters make great readers. Often we have a little book discussion as the boat whistles past Alcatraz and the Mount Tam shadows in the background, and the bridge is silhouetted against the sun. But I'm sometimes deep involved in the pages of a book. And that makes me think about vacations, because I think a book is a great traveling companion. If you're driving in a car and you're listening to an audio book, it takes your mind off the traffic, keeps your mind on the road, but takes you often to different places. And then if you're at an airport and you've got that 6-hour flight, which may well be delayed, out comes the book. I'm still a kind of an aficionado of the printed page, and by that I'm talking about page turners, where the print comes, I believe, into your hand, up your arm, and slowly you digest the words. So I am reviewing today primarily printed books, which in many instances are also available as electronic or Kindles. Three are non-fiction, and my first recommendation for the summer is The Man Who Saved the Union, Ulysses Grant in War and Peace. This is a magnificent biography by H.W. Brands. He teaches at the University of Texas. He's written other historical biographies, but I will put this amongst the best in his choices. And to me, Grant is an interesting president. He's come in for much revision recently, and his life really divides into two sections. As a commander on the battlefield, he, of course, is the one who brings the American Civil War to its conclusion at Appomattox. And then, after a brief interim under Johnson, he then is elected president. And if you view his presidency, the initial take is that there were too many different scandals, whether they're economic, whether they're financial, social, nepotism, corruption, that tended to scar an immediate assessment. But if you take the long-term view of Grant, he was the one who wanted to see the actual peace terms that Lincoln envisaged brought into action. And I think that's particularly important. He led a successful campaign against the Ku Klux Klan. He reformed the civil service. And when we look at his legacy in terms of civil rights, it would take almost 100 years into the 1960s to actually see implemented what he had started in the 1870s. His own writing, The Memoirs of Grant, which actually were edited by Mark Twain, is still one of the great memoirs of then and today. So I'm very pleased to see a worthy biography do justice to a president who sometimes has been largely underestimated. The book, The Man Who Saved the Union, the author H.W. Grant. Now, if we move up to contemporary times, and I think we are living in an age which, for different reasons, I think not unlike happenings during the presidency of Grant, when we think of political corruption and bank failures, I often think of that line of Mark Twain, that history doesn't repeat itself, history rhymes. And that makes sense to me. And two recent books, in different ways, approach the same area of subject. The first is by the New Yorker writer George Packard. It's called The Unwinding, An Inner History of the New America. And I highly recommend this if you're interested in looking at trends, how things are changing, and where the future may be taking us. Packer essentially keeps himself out of the story. So it's third-person narrative. He lets the characters speak for themselves. And this is a set of very, very interesting profiles. The range of people that he introduces and actually used as interviews range from a long-time union man to a Silicon entrepreneur. And, of course, there are some of the great celebrities. He includes Oprah Winfrey, just to name a few of them. And, of course, Newt Gingrich gets a look in. Now, what he is interested in finding out is how the past has really changed into the present. And so we move from a union worker in Youngstown, Ohio, to an entrepreneur in North Carolina, to a DC insider, and to a Silicon Valley innovator. How have these people adjusted from a life they knew in the 1970s to what it means when some of these institutions and corporations have disappeared? And I think what Packer does is actually pose a very, very interesting question. And I think what is even more interesting, he leaves the reader to draw their own individual decisions. I would recommend this book to anyone who sees the change that has happened in America. Although it is never stated, Packer is asking his readers seemingly a simple question. What does it mean to be an American? What do we want with this country? And what do we want it to be? What is the price of freedom or the loss of common bonds? And what is it that keeps us all together or, in fact, disrupts us? Highly recommended. The book title, once again, The Unwinding, An Inner History of the New America. And by contrast, the economic historian Neil Ferguson is next on my list. The Great Degeneration, How Institutions Decay and Economies Die. The title is not quite as pessimistic as it suggests, because he does hang out a little bit of hope. But I think two interesting things I took from this. And the first is the way the country now is becoming more and more regulated. Everybody has the regulators crawling and creeping all over them, not just the banks, the corporations, the safety institutions, environmental safety, ecology. So where does this leave the individual and the individual freedom to do what was once part of what the Great American Dream was built on? And I think that's a real question. And it's particularly a real question if you're in small business, because to be in small business and then to meet all the demands that regulation nowadays imposes, I think floats the question, is it worth working for yourself? And if you work for yourself, how many of these forms do you have to complete simply to set up shop. Neil Ferguson, in the end, does come down against regulation. And, of course, regulation is the alternative to when the banks ran wild. And one of his favourite recommendations is to reread de Tocqueville, Democracy in America, a book which came out in 1848, and where de Tocqueville actually revelled on the number of local communities, whether they were churches, whether they were social groups, whether they were clubs, that worked together to be America. And they brought all sorts of elements of society together, and they took care of a lot of the social, medical and educational needs. And today, he sees people forgetting these institutions. Clubland disappears, social organisations diminish, and we look to the state, which therefore means more government, and of course it then becomes a political issue. And as Tip O'Neill once says, all politics are local. You went to your local institution. The local institution now depends on state funding. So again, my third suggestion in the realm of non-fiction, it's the new Neil Ferguson book, the title, The Great Degeneration, How Institutions Decay and Economies Die. Now, if you're in that deck chair on the beach, the sand is blowing in your hair, and you're looking for something a little easier, two suggestions. The first is Kate Atkinson. I've liked her earlier books, and this time it's called Life After Life. And it follows the heroine through all the events of the 20th century, shifting from historical outcomes to a second sort of succession of alternative realities. It's widely inventive, deeply felt, at times very funny, and above all, very humane. So this is something of a reasonably fast page-turner, well worth reading, Life After Life, written by the great Kate Atkinson. And a book which will take you this time into Mexico at the time of the Mexican Revolution, The Five Acts of Diego Leone. It's a colourful narrative, and the author, Alex Espinosa, brings the settings of a small rural village in Mexico at the height of the Mexican Revolution. The character at the centre of the book lives a pretty easygoing life, singing, dancing, stories of romance, and then suddenly tragedy strikes. And here we are again in the heart of a really big dispute between landowners, aristocrats, and anyone else who gets caught in the crossfire. I would recommend this as a kind of escape novel. And, of course, it has a beautiful picture on the front. I'll leave you to pick it up yourself. The title one more time, The Five Acts of Diego Leone, and the author, Alexis Espinosa. Now, I did mention driving, and I find that an audio book for me definitely makes a great, great travelling companion. I get wrapped up in the story, I move from character to character, and suddenly all the hassle of congestion on the highway or the freeway diminishes.
Nowadays, it's even easier to take these audiobooks because you can load them onto your watch. You can load them onto your iPhone through iTunes. So it's no excuse now not to have an audiobook at the ready on your trip.
Yeah, that's true. And they're easy to download and extremely portable. So it's portable audio, but the voice comes through. And I know I've mentioned it before, like good radio, an audiobook is the theatre of the mind because it paints pictures for you and suddenly you get entwined in the lives of the characters. There are two different versions out there of The Great Gatsby, which is something, if you've seen the movie, it's not a bad thing to actually listen to the book. And one of the joys of Scott Fitzgerald's writing is that you can hear the tinkling of the jazz piano in the background. Songs like Ain't We Have Fun and Ain't We Got Fun almost rings on every page. You can also create in your head what you think Daisy should look like or what the hideous Tom Buchanan would act like, and maybe put your own inference on Nick Carraway as he tells this story of unrelented love, unrequited love, murder, romance, cars, and of course the music. So I would suggest listening just to make something different to The Great Gatsby. And my final suggestion today, one I've mentioned briefly before, a Delicate Truth, the great new John le Carré. And the reason I bring it up again is that he really hits outsourcing in the secrecy brigade. So when I listen to the revelations coming from the National Security Agency, this time through the voice of Booz Allen and the person of Snowden, Eric Snowden, out there in Hong Kong, I'm thinking, is this what it is nowadays, corporations controlling the nation's national security? Well, if you're interested in that subject, John le Carré, A Delicate Truth, is my tip-top recommendation for you.
Thank you, Peter, for those suggestions. Good picks all, especially the history ones. I have to look at that, The Man Who Saved the Union, H.W. Brands, and The Unwinding by George Packer. That's particularly intrigued me.
And just for anybody who wants a live literary discussion, The Great Gatsby, in fact, is the subject of the next soiree at the San Francisco Literary Society. It's Tuesday, June the 9th. We're running excerpts from three of the different earlier versions. We have readings from the text. It's a fun evening. Begin with a cocktail party just to go nice. So you want the drinks with the umbrellas, the place to be. And the number for that is 415-381-6671. That's The Great Gatsby evening at the San Francisco Literary Society, 415-381-6671.
Peter Robinson, always a pleasure having you on. Thanks for being here.
Thank you, David.
I should also mention, in terms of things to do this weekend, in addition to the film festival's opening and the film festival's closing, that I was ear witness last night to a truly spectacular performance of Stravinsky's Rite of Spring with Michael Tilson Thomas and the San Francisco Symphony. It starts with the most iconic and fear-inducing solos for the bassoon repertoire, as was discussed a while back by principal bassoonist Stephen Paulson, who was my guest here on Open Air a few months back. And it was executed brilliantly by Steve last night and in the coming performance. Spectacular brass and wind playing as well. Some 9 French horns involved. Stunning strings, which last night also included additional Stravinsky in the form of his violin concerto, played enthusiastically and brilliantly by Gil Shaham. The remaining performances of Rite of Spring, intruding on my voiceover here, are this Saturday and Sunday. And those performances will also include Stravinsky's Les Noces and a Dmitri Pakovsky Ensemble performing traditional Russian songs. Information for those remaining concerts at sfsymphony.org. Here's a little bit of strains of Rite of Spring to close things out on Open Air. just a touch of Stravinsky's Le Sacre du Printemps, the Rite of Spring. We heard in that recording Bernard Haitink and the London Philharmonic Orchestra. The spectacular San Francisco Symphony's performances remain this weekend. sfsymphony.org for more information. Thanks to Ashley Ann Krigbaum for helping out with today's show while producer Neil Swinkles enjoys some time away. A reminder that all of Open Air's shows are available for listening anytime at our website, kalw.org. Search for Open Air or use the pull-down menu under Music and the Arts. I'm David LaTulipe. Thanks for listening. An hour of news from the BBC is next here on KALW and at kalw.org, followed by All Things Considered at 3 o'clock.